There's something very interesting about both of you.
Okay.
And you'll forgive me for going a little bit deep. Mm-hmm. You two have something obvious in common. You're both
Jewish
and relatively easygoing and happy. But somewhere deep. You sure you want me to go there? There's a certain loneliness that goes hand in hand with a certain fear that goes hand in hand, but slightly different than, but there's a certain sadness which you don't see on the surface. And you guys, I don't know if you've discovered it yet, something that's there, deep, and you cover it, but you really know it's there. The question is, how much time have you taken to think about it? Now, it's not the same. It's not the same. It's just, by both of you, it's deep. It's very interesting. Okay, we'll discuss how you know this stuff in at the very end. I'll teach you a little bit about how you do this. But what's interesting is that it seems like you're going to spend your life that way. Meaning, the way things are now, it looks like that's going to be the way it's going to go. But we have a tradition. We have two interesting traditions. We have a few interesting traditions. One is that God created the world in a way that you could read palms of the hands. That's what the Talmud says. It says there is wisdom in palm reading. But it's been a few thousand years since the Talmud. And Nachmanides, the Ramban, says that we lost that wisdom. So when you go to a palm reader today, the question is, what worth do they have? And that I'll get back to at the end of class. So how did I... there is certain wisdom in it. But we have another tradition that says that a Jew can always overcome even what it says on the stars, even what it says, even what his luck, so to speak, is predestined. A Jew is not limited by that because the Jewish people weren't predestined to exist. Meaning God decided they should exist, but Avram naturally could not have kids. So the Jewish people all come from Avram, and Avram, according to the stars, could not have kids. So the kids he had and the people that are his continuation are people that are beyond nature. We're not limited by nature. If it were up to nature, we'd be gone. You guys know who John McCain is?
Yeah.
So he has a brother. I think his name is Ed McCain. I don't remember his name. He just wrote a letter last week about the Jewish people. About the Jewish people in Iran. He says people are concerned about Iran wiping the Jewish people off the map. And I'm not concerned. Because if you study Jewish history, you see that they should have been wiped out so many times in their history. They're beyond that. But what is the concept? Why are we still here? Because we're not under the stars. We don't live by natural rules. So, even though I'm about to tell you about what your palms say, that's not limiting. But you should be aware of it. Because if nothing is done about it, then the way things stand now, it looks like this is something that's going to remain there. It's not going to leave. It's not going to change. And what your palms seem to say is that it's much more convenient to ignore it and not address it and make believe it's not there. But deep down inside, you know that you cannot attain a feeling of wholesomeness, true happiness, unless you deal with it. So I'm sorry I went that deep. I'm sorry, because it's not something that anyone would want to discuss. I wouldn't want someone to tell me that deep into my palm. What?
Nothing that I don't know already, actually.
Ah,
yeah.
Okay. So,
the question is what you do about it.
Oh, the question is what do you do about it? And I want to go to a seemingly unrelated topic. We're going to discuss two seemingly unrelated topics, and then we'll come back to here. I want to begin with a look at marriage, at human relationships. Are your parents divorced or married? Oh, Hashem, your parents also?
Yeah.
Okay. First of all, you guys are very lucky. Hi, Ellie. Good morning. Baruch haba. Can I see your palm?
No.
Your palm? The palm of your hand? Interesting. I can't talk about you right now. We did them, but there's more to say about you. I'm sorry. We can't go back. We'll have to move forward. If you want, then the class will come back to you. But you're interesting. You're not exactly like me. But similar. But different in an important way. Most people are unhappy in marriage. Ask 80% of the people who are married, if they have to do it all over again, would they do it? And they'd say no. And the surprise is that 20% would say yes. there's what to discuss about that. But I want us to begin with a thought. I want each of you to think, and then I want to hear what you describe as an ideal relationship. Think for a minute.
Ideal relationship?
What is an ideal relationship? And if we could limit it to 5 factors, we'll limit it to that. Ellie, you ready?
Not really.
Still thinking?
5 factors.
Now I feel like Aristotle.
What?
Now I feel like Aristotle.
Why?
Because Aristotle always said define.
Define love. That's very hard. I don't think it was ever made
of love. Aristotle discussed that too. Something lovable, for it is loved, or is it loved, for it is lovable. Yeah.
Sesame Street has said that love is hugs and kisses and a warm feeling on the inside.
Okay.
What's a successful relationship where you enjoy giving...
Wait. I don't think he's finished yet.
Yeah. Okay, so... Love, whatever that is. Another factor. Trust. Trust each other. Partnership. No, that's a bad word. It doesn't mean trust.
Respect.
Respect. So
okay, 1 second. Do you have any more? Simon adds respect, yeah?
Yeah, love and trust. Like, they all go under the same umbrella, sort of. And also, I don't know how to describe this in one word, but, like, you have to... Like, an ideal relationship is not that you're, like... But you agree on everything all the time because you're two different people and you do discuss and you do have issues. But to solve them in a way that don't lead to divorce. Like, I think, I don't know, like, you know, like, people, like, even though there are different opinions or, like, yeah, different opinions within a relationship where you have issues or you have problems, like, to solve them instead of, I don't know, it's very difficult to explain. but I know that they're like...
I called it capacity to solve issues.
Yeah.
Okay. To work together, to work things out.
Yeah.
Okay, so we have five. You guys want to add something else? Ellie, we haven't heard anything from left field.
Yeah, but like also where you can like share everything. The ideal would be that you'd be married to your best friend. Also, you'd be your best friend partner. Yeah, be assigned to you.
Yeah, totally.
Okay. Benji.
I don't know if I agree with that. I mean, I want my wife to be my best friend, but I feel like emotionally, like I don't want to affect her sometimes because, like, if she's having a good day and I tell her something, then she gets very, very emotionally affected by it. So I don't want to ruin her day being a best friend. It's like, I don't know, it's like you're not so emotionally intertwined or relied on each other, and you're not emotionally fused together, either through physical relationship, or you're fused together once you're married, and you affect one another.
I wouldn't agree with best friend either, because you need to be like a very good friend and trust and be able to talk to your wife about not anything but most things and respect. But the problem is that if there is a problem, or in this case, like there's an emotional issue or something, you might like. It affects not only your wife, but then you might not only like be angry with your wife then, but also your friend. Like you could lose a friend on the
Of course.
But I mean, I don't think that having your wife as a best friend is not the ideal.
Okay, so here are my five things. A shared goal of being married, meaning you both have to view as an ideal being married, so that like when certain things are come in contact, like you get a job far away, meaning that one of them, like, you'll have shared goals, but you don't have to have the same shared goal. You don't have to vote for the same political party. So the number two would be respect for each other's differences.
Yeah.
Number three would be trust.
The first one was shared goal.
I mean, a lot
shared
of these are things that I see as like the same things that I'd like to have, like my best friend.
You're saying with a guy also?
Yeah, a guy or a girl who's your best friend. I have.
So one second. So number four would be attraction. I would say emotional attraction, like physical attraction. Because that's not a quality I was looking for in a best friend, but if that's important for a wife. Number five. I feel like anything I would think of is already involved in the other four.
I have a question. What was the question we began with?
The idea. What was it, marriage?
What are the five? Name five.
Ideal. Marriage.
Kids?
Okay.
If you don't have kids, you can still have a happy marriage.
Yes, I would believe that of course you can, but I would believe that the ideal marriage for me would be with kids. Even though I would love my wife.
You don't want kids, then it's not so ideal.
No, but for me it would be with kids.
Two and a half?
But not when they're like screaming and drooling and
you give them back.
First,
put them back inside.
I give them away for 5 years and then I take them back. Yeah.
We'll get there. We'll get there. You're assuming I had five I thought of.
Oh, yeah. Assuming you had they all start with W or something.
Nope. I don't have a specific five. I have a specific thought, which I think most people miss. Freud said a lot of nonsense, and some good things too. So he said one thing which I think is a good thing. He said there are two decisions that come from the depths of who a person is, and no one can really comprehend those decisions, and sometimes not even the person themselves. And that is the decision what job a person takes, and the decision who a person marries. Now, if the decision of who we marry is really a question of these logical factors, why would it come from the depths? I'll quote to you a conversation. Wife says to husband, "Why do you love me?" Husband says, "Because you're beautiful." Wife says to husband, "And what happens when I'll be pregnant?" "You'll still be beautiful." Wife says to husband, "But I won't look like anyone else you call beautiful." Husband says, "Yeah, it's a different beauty." Wife says to husband, "Why do you love me?" Husband says, "Because you're smart." Wife says to husband, "Oh, so if I'm going to spend the next 20 years bringing up your kids and I won't be top of my class and I won't know top of the news, you won't love me?" "No, I'll still love you." Wife says to husband, "Why do you love me?" Husband says, "Because you're my best friend." Wife says to husband, "Oh, you know, best friends sometimes break up. Are we also going to break up?" Wife says to husband, "Why do you love me?" Husband says to wife, "Because you respect me." We don't have to continue. I'm taking the things you guys said, and I'm asking you, if your wife asks you, "Why do you love me?" would any of these be a good answer? Forget your wife's questions. What about your own question? If you ask yourself, "Is this the person I want to marry?"
But it's not just, okay, fine, but you can't divide it into, "Why do you love me?" because you are my best friend, or because I respect you, or because you are beautiful.
Oh, so you say all
it's
five.
It's like a package.
So you'll say all five.
Yeah, but she won't lose all five.
Ah, okay. So you're saying it's a checklist. You go out with a girl, you look at the checklist, you no, put a check by the
yes,
ones,
yes.
And fine.
Scale, you're rating on a scale of 1 to 10. I'm looking for a 9.3.
So I gave you the answer before I started with the question, but yeah, I'm listening. No, yeah, you don't have to agree with my answer.
I mean, like, yeah, it's true what you said, like, it's not... You can't define it logically, but these are like the factors that for a successful relationship.
Oh. So that's what I wanted you guys to see.
That's the key.
That's exactly the point. This isn't how you're going to choose your wife.
No.
But these are factors that are important. Yeah. You guys notice the difference?
Mm-hmm.
Now
the question, so we answered.
That's why I asked you, what question did I ask you? I was very fair. I asked you in advance. So then let's go on to the next question. If these are only factors of an ideal marriage, so then how do we choose a wife? We don't. How do you get married?
Your parents do. I don't know.
Let me tell you, this is a question... this is a question I get often.
Yeah.
And I have a very strange answer for it. But and from that answer, we're going to go on to the next conversation, and then we'll put all three conversations together. I want to begin by quoting an aunt. When my brother was dating, so my aunt called him up and said to him, "Look, there are different kinds of shoes in life. There are high heels, there are dress shoes, there are sneakers. There are all kinds of shoes in life. There are shoes you wear when you go hiking. You need them to hold your foot, to hold your ankle, high tops. There are shoes you wear when you're playing basketball. There are shoes you're wearing when you're going to a wedding. There are shoes, all kinds of shoes for different occasions. A wife is like a shoe. Some people marry a wife because she can go hiking with them. Some people marry a wife because she looks nice, like the dress shoes. Listen here, you need a wife that's like slippers. Outside the house, you're going to wear your dress shoes and your sneakers and everything else. When you come home, you need slippers. You don't need anything else. So you find a wife. He was dating his wife at the time. She said, "If you want to know if this is your wife or not, Are you comfortable like with slippers? Is that that's the formula? And I word it a little bit differently, and then I'll refine it. I word it in a practical sense. Are you yourself with this person? Are you happy with who you are? Are you comfortable with yourself with this person? Is this person themselves when they're with you, and are they happy with who they are? And are you happy with who they are? And are they happy with who you are? Meaning, each person has to be comfortable with themselves and with the other person. If we feel good about being with one another, that's already, and we could be ourselves. That's already a tremendous indicator that this is it. Now, you'll tell me, well, who don't you feel comfortable with? So the Japanese have a saying. They say, there is no lie. We're all different people in front of different people. Meaning that by the Japanese, you're always allowed to lie. Because if you're in front of your boss, so you speak one way, you're never going to admit you failed in front of your boss. And they justify it by saying, look, when you're with your friends, you curse. When you're in front of your parents, you don't curse, right? You behave differently in front of different people. So they take it to an extreme and they legitimize all forms of lying. They just say it depends who's in the neighborhood. That's the answer you're supposed to give. In Japanese culture, that's a given. You ask someone a question in front of his boss, so he's entitled to give you a different answer. His boss was there. It's part of the culture. So we're all that way to an extent. But our wife has to be someone with whom I can be whole with myself. Now, think back to where we started. And I want you to at least see where we're headed. We live in an age where I get a phone call the other night. A guy tells me, I want to come to class, but there's a girl that wants to go out with me. So I tell him, well, do you want to go out with her? So he says, yeah. So I say, okay, look, you have to get married, so go on a date. He says, no, it's not that kind of date. So I say, what do you mean? He says, well, she and I both know that the date is going to end up in my house and we're going to spend the night together. So I tell him, I don't understand. You're dating for marriage? You're dating So he said, no, she's a girl. We're friendly. She's alone. I'm alone. So that's the way it's going to be. So I said, okay, come to class. So the guy says to me, but if I come to class, I'm going to feel like I'm not a man. So I learned a new concept that that's how we measure manlyhood.
Being a man is being with girls?
Oh, so in his mind it was.
Yeah.
Let's look at the Torah. The Torah, when it prohibits lesbian relationship, how does the Torah describe it?
Homosexual?
No. Woman with a woman. You guys know how the Torah describes it? Sure, the Torah does. Torah says, "Kema'asei eretz Mitzrayim," like the actions of the Egyptians. "Asher yishavtemba," that you dwelled in Egypt. "Lo ta'asun," do not perform. Don't do like the Egyptians. So Egypt was a place where that was rampant, and when the Torah wants to prohibit it, the Torah uses terminology, as the Torah always does, that is more modest. And the Torah just says, don't behave like the Egyptians behaved. We have on tradition that what the Torah meant was that. But the Torah doesn't explicitly say it. The Torah just alludes to it. Now, we know about Egyptian. The Navi Yechezkel tells us that the Egyptians were rampant. They were going around from woman to woman. I mean, we have on tradition that when the plague of the firstborn struck, people were dropping like flies because God hit whoever was the first son of every man and whoever was the first son of every woman and the first son of relationships, and the women were all cheating on their husbands and the husbands were all cheating on their wives. So everyone had many firstborn children from many different wives. So you ask yourself, if men were so available, why were the women going with other women? Think about it. They had marriages, they had men, and the men were all running around chasing after women. Why were the women looking after other men? Or after women? What?
It's exciting, it's fun. Maybe they were living like, I don't know.
So,
like women,
doesn't seem that way from the picture the Torah paints. Let's, I want to throw a suggestion at you. If the men are not connecting with the women when they're together, if the relationship is all physical, so then to the women, that's not a connection. Meaning, you don't love me. You guys use the word love, and I want to get back to the word love. But what is love? Or what is at the core of a relationship between a husband and a wife? Do you know that the average couple has secrets? No. I'm not talking about secrets like they agreed they'd keep their budget down to this much and he went out and bought a snack and he's not going to tell her. I'm not talking about those kinds of secrets.
They keep secrets from each other, that they together have
No. They keep secrets from one another, and not only secrets, but if you ask every one of the couples, you ask the husband, you ask the wife, have you ever really shared with your spouse what's deepest inside of you, who you really are, what your deepest desire or fear are, your average spouse is going to say no. Your average husband and your average wife is going to say no. Now, what does that mean? That people are living within a marriage and they could never completely connect. What is the thing that is most driving a person to marriage? I'll tell you the secret. It's universal. The thing that drives a person to get married or remain married is loneliness. But it's not loneliness. I go to sleep at night and all I have is my bachelor's pizza and I have a dark room to myself. No. It's not a loneliness that I have fantasies and I can't fulfill them. Not that. It's a loneliness that stems from the depths of a person's being. And now I will reveal a secret. I cheated you guys. When you guys came in and I looked at your palms, so I studied palm reading a little bit, just like I studied a lot of things. I've read Rav Soloveitchik also. But in my youth, when I was a magician, I also read books on fortune-telling and palm reading. And the first thing you do when a person walks in is you tell him, you know, deep down inside, I sense there's something lonely. There's something dark. There's something sad. And it's always true.
Because you tend to find it in the most people.
Because everyone has it. Not most. Every single one of us has that place deep, deep down inside of us that is lonely and sad and dark. And what is it? Most people don't know. So now I want to take you with me to a journey. Ah, you guys have to think about it. I see it has to settle in. I cheated you, so it has to settle in.
That's like the same. It's the same thing. Like no, just people say that they can talk to the dead, or they can.
It's a different discussion.
Like I sense someone with a J, like someone begins with a J. Yeah, Johnny. Yeah, Johnny. Yeah, because yeah, like it's.
Wait, it takes much more talent than that.
Yeah, but yeah.
I could tell you. I could give you a whole fortune telling class, and I will be able to tell you a lot about yourself. There's a lot to it.
But you're not telling us. You're saying things and we're applying it to ourselves.
To an extent. But the first thing is get something universal.
Yeah, exactly.
But wait a second. You understand what that means? The universal. You tell a person there's something happy about your life. Sometimes yes, sometimes no. You tell a person there's something exciting happening in your life. Maybe yes, maybe no. You tell a person there's something worthwhile. There's something that's scaring you right now. No. You tell a person that deep down inside, there is an area where you're lonely, scared, sad, and every person is going to say yes. That's the only thing you could tell a person. You tell him deep down inside there's an area where you're really happy, he's not going to agree with you. You tell him, but deep down inside there's an area where you're really scared, or you're really sad, or you're really lonely, and every person will agree with you. He might not admit it, but it's the truth. And the question is, what is that? What is that place that's so lonely and sad that most people spend most of their lives never confronting and never dealing with and never resolving? Let's begin with did I ever tell you, you guys ever hear the story of the farmer who married the princess? So there was once a shepherd, not a farmer, who was watching sheep. And he took his sheep out to the waters. And as he brought the sheep there, the princess happened to be coming to the waters. And she was walking, looking at the beautiful swans in the lake. And he was there feeding his sheep. And she saw how caring he was of his sheep. So she went over to him and she started talking to him. And he was unaware that she was the princess. So he's talking to her. And their relationship is formed. And they start meeting by this stream every day. And after a few months, they decide they want to get married. And then she has to reveal to him that she's a princess. And he tells her, look, but I'm not a prince. I can only lead the life of a simple shepherd. And she says, no, I like you the way you are. I want to live life with you the way you live life, not the way I live life. So he says, okay, I can't offer you any better, but this is the life I lead. If you want us to get married, so we can. So she asks her father's permission, and her father is against it. But she tells him, no, I've known this guy now for a few months. And her father is shocked. And after she explains what had happened, her father sees he has no choice. And her father says, let me make him a noble. Let me make him a prince. Let me help him out. And she says, no, he's going to lead that life. And I'm going to go lead that life with him. And the father admires her courage and her will. So her father says, fine, if that's the way you want to go. I'm here when you need me. But fine, we'll make a wedding the way you two wish, and you have my blessing. They get married, and they're very happy. And then the shepherd decides he wants to bring his new wife a surprise. So the first Shabbos, they're supposed to be together. He comes home, and he has a big piece of wool, and as they're sitting down for the meal, she asks him, what's in that wool? He says, I have a surprise for you, honey. So she says, really? Wow, that's amazing. She goes over and takes off the wool. And under the wool, she sees a bucket. And in the bucket, she sees oats. So she says, oats? So he said, yeah, delicious, fresh oats. I just got them today and I wanted them for you. So she musters a smile and she says, thank you. And she sits down and she starts chewing the dry oats together with him. And he's smiling. He's happy as can be. She swallows and she doesn't say anything. She's a princess. She's used to eating cakes, fluff. She's a few days later, he comes home and he has a little bag. And he walks in with this bag. She asks him, what's in the kerchief? He tells her, I have another gift for you. This time she's less excited. She opens the kerchief, and inside she sees a bunch of shearings. She says, wool shearings? He says, yeah, I sheared the wool for the first time today. And I wanted you to have the first shearings. I'm going to put them in a pillow for you. You're going to have a very nice pillow. Oh, she was used to sleeping on the finest beds and the finest pillows. So this is his gift. So again, she musters a smile. And later on in the week, he wants to bring her another surprise. So he comes home and he brings her some freshly cut wheat. So she says, honey, what's that? He tells her, you'll grind it. You'll make fresh bread. I'll grind the wheat. How do I do that? I'll show you. If I bought it for you, it's fresh. It's new. It's dry. It's perfect. And she's not excited anymore. So he looks at her and he says, I don't understand. I got you the best wheat. You know how much I took a half hour off my work today to go searching where they have the finest wheat that you could have very good, delicious bread. She says, I know. You're right, you did the best. And day after day, he's bringing her oats and wheat and shearings, and he's all excited, and she's not. And at some point, they reach the conclusion that she's just of a different class. This isn't what's going to excite her. And he can't get her jewelry, and he can't get her anything that she's even used to on her daily life. This is a mashal that the Medrash says about our soul. It says, "V'anifesh lo timale." The soul is never going to be satiated. We come to this world, and God places within us something godly. A soul. And that soul is desiring something. And we try to give it things that are way beneath its dignity. We tell it, come, look at this beautiful TV show. It's not interested. We get excited, and the soul is not. We give it delicious food to eat, we get excited, and the soul is not. We give it coarse entertainment, and the soul is a princess. She's down in this world, and she's just getting lonely. But God gave us a gift. God gave us a gift in which we could make her happy. But we'll get to that in a minute. You guys starting to see the connection? See where we're headed? A little bit. The phone rang, and it was him again. And I always dreaded conversations with him. Because he was very smart. At the age of 16, he had already attained his first degree. At the age of 19, he was sitting in college courses correcting his professors. By 22, he had his PhD. He was really brilliant. But I dreaded the conversations with him. And he began the conversation as he usually did, very pleasantly. How are you? How are things? You have some time today? Maybe we'll get together. And I knew that I was one of his few friends, so we got together. And the conversation went the way it usually went. And this time I was a little bit tired of the conversation, so I said, you know, we've been through this. Don't buy it, don't. And he looked at me and he said, what do you mean, don't buy it, don't? I said, you don't believe God exists. So he doesn't exist. Fine, we've been through this conversation many times. And he looked at me. And for the first time since we knew one another, it had been quite a few years, and I knew he was a very fine person, but that was the first time I ever saw him get angry. And he simply got angry, and he started yelling at me. And I said to him, what are you so upset about? You've been arguing for the last 2-3 years, ever since we've started our friendship, that God doesn't exist. He's not around. I'm tired. Fine. So he doesn't exist. Fine. Continue life. Go ahead. Good luck. Live your life, assuming God doesn't exist. So he said to me, do you think you're being fair? I said, yes. Perfectly fair. Shalom Maha. I asked him, what's wrong? If you've been arguing the point, so let's just go your route. Fine, it doesn't exist. Live your life. Why are you upset? And he stopped. And he thought. It was Shabbos afternoon. And we're friends. I trusted him. I said to him, you know what? I'm really tired. I'm going to go to sleep. And I knew he had nothing better to do with his time. So I said, you could read any of the books. You're welcome to any of the food. We'll talk after I get up. And I went to sleep. And he stayed. And about an hour and a half later, I woke to see him in the same position I had left him, standing there thinking. So I asked him,
Come here.
מעני?
כן.
Excuse me. All the boys and all the.
If we've already stopped, I'll tell you guys something interesting. We had a group of Venezuelans here.
They left already?
Yeah, they came for 10 days. And Rav Neri came over, and before I started with them, and he told me, I'm telling you, you got to go this route, you got to go that route, you got to go the third route. I said, okay, I've been teaching for a few years, but he's telling me, fine. I walk into the class, I said, guys, Rav Neri says you want this, this, and another thing. They said, yup. And I would have never given them that. They wanted fantastic stories about the Garden of Eden and perdition and kinds of things like that, which I never talk about. I mean, there are midrashim about it, but that's just not me. But that's what they wanted, so that's what we did. And then they got up at the end of class, and they just hugged me. First time I ever had that. We finished class. They were so excited. That was so beautiful. I would have never done that. But Rav Neri told me, so he's got experience. I bow my head. That's what he recommends. So I looked at him and I said, tell me, what are you so upset about? So he said to me, I don't believe God exists. I said, yeah, that's where we began our conversation. And I respect that, fine. So he doesn't exist. So he said to me, I don't think God exists. And if you're playing mind games with me, you're not going to convince me that God exists. So I said to him, I know, you're much smarter than me. I'm not going to play mind games with you. I've decided that, fine, God doesn't exist, fine. Yeah. So he said to me, then come turn on this light. So I said to him, it's Shabbos. I don't turn on lights on Shabbos. And he said to me, well, if you agree that God doesn't exist, so what do you care about Shabbos? So I said to him, it's interesting that you asked me to turn on the light, but you didn't turn on the light. So let me pose the question back to you. Now that God doesn't exist, why aren't you turning on the light on Shabbos? So he said, very, very fascinating remark. He said to me, let's sit together and paint paradise. If we're going to write a science fiction book, we just write a book about, we could create whatever paradise we want. What do you think most people would put in that paradise? They'd put cell phones where they could see one another and talk. That was before you could see one another on cell phones. Cell phones were just coming out. Most people didn't have cell phones. There's a story that goes back about 15, 20 years. They'd put cell phones that people could see one another and were affordable and everyone had those cell phones. They'd put the capacity for people to leap from place to place. They'd put places where people would have springs of chocolate milk. They'd put all kinds of things. But you know what? If they'd ever go there, they wouldn't be happy there. If the world will reach a point, this is what he told me 20 years ago, if the world will reach a point where people could talk to their friends at any second of their lives. Now, that wasn't the time before SMSs. I mean, the average person didn't have cell phones. I don't know how old are you guys. 20 years was before you were born. So let me tell you something. There was a time when the average person did not have a cell phone. This was the world. I mean, there were no SMSs. But he told me back then, he said, if the world will reach a point where people can talk to their friends at every moment and people can have at a very cheap price, they can have all the amenities that we can't even imagine 20 years ago. And I mean, to a great extent, he was right. I mean, back then, I didn't know what email was. I didn't know. I mean, I remember reading in Encyclopedia Brown, I think it was, or one of these books, that this kid had email and I couldn't figure out what it was. Like, as a kid, when I'd read and he wrote about this concept. I mean, back then, no one knew what email was. He didn't know. I mean, this is before you guys were born, but the world once was without internet. I mean, the world did not use internet. So he said to me, if we reach this point, people are going to be very lonely. And I didn't understand them. I said, what do you mean? People could talk to one another. They could have their friends with them all day. So yeah, you get tired of your friends. But why are people going to be lonely? He said to me, if we draw a paradise, but that paradise revolves around my capacity to do and enjoy, people won't do and people won't enjoy. So I said, okay, what are you driving at? Because this was a little bit beyond me. He said to me, paradise is where you don't have to do. Paradise is where you could stop, connect with yourself, and connect with your Creator. And the only taste of paradise that I have in this world is on this day when I cannot turn on a light. I don't know if God exists, but I do know that the day I decide that I stop believing and I stop keeping Shabbos, that's the last day I have paradise on this planet. The only time a person can stop and connect with himself and connect with the one who created the world is Shabbos. He told me then, he said, it's the thing I have the greatest respect for in Judaism, because the whole world is running around searching for paradise. And we were given a gift that once a week we have it. Now, I don't believe. And he made a declaration then. And I won't continue the story about what he did with the light switch and everything else and where his life went since then. The guy ended up committing suicide. I mean, to make a long story short. But he was brilliant. I mean, we were good friends. He was simply brilliant. Like a child prodigy. His primary issue was that his best friend was murdered before his eyes. So he went around his whole life trying to search out how could God exist if such a cruel thing happened. That was his... he lived in America. He was a drunk driver, came and mowed him down. He was a kid. He couldn't handle that. So all his philosophical debates always revolved around good and bad and God. How could there be bad if God is good? So God is bad or God doesn't exist? And he decided God doesn't exist. And then he decided, well, if God doesn't exist, then there's no reason I should exist. And he took his own life. That's why I'm summarizing a few years into a nutshell. But he said that amazing line. He said to me, you know, we were given a gift of paradise. When a person lives his whole life and he never takes the time to connect to himself, he's not living. He's running around chasing his shadow. He's no different than the dog chasing his tail. What's he chasing after? He's chasing after, let me get the latest cell phone, the latest SMS. In his day, we didn't have that. He was foreseeing. He said, if you're going to give people a paradise where they have streams of chocolate milk, they're going to wake up in the morning and they're going to ask themselves, what can I enjoy today? And even if you can create it in a way that every day has its thrills and they enjoy it, every day has a new amusement park, something better and better and better and better, that's Olam Haba. We say Olam Haba, it's always coming. There's always an up-and-coming event that's even better. The world to come, you never get bored of, but that's because it's spiritual. He said, if in the physical world, you will be able to paint a world which is just better and better and better, and every day you have what to get up for, you still haven't created paradise. Because people are simply running. When you stop, and you could connect to yourself, then you can give a person paradise. Now let's go back to where we began. If at the root of every person there is sadness and loneliness and a dark, dark place, then the gift Hashem gave us was a day when we stop and we can connect to ourselves. Not only we connect to ourselves, Hashem connects to us. That loneliness, as we discussed earlier, is a loneliness that people don't share with their spouses. It's a loneliness that's at the core of a person's being, and it's a loneliness that people don't resolve. And because they don't resolve it, they never attain true happiness. When Hashem gave us Shabbos, Hashem gave us a gift of a time when we can resolve that loneliness. If we maintain Shabbos properly, if Shabbos has the spiritual effect, not the physical effect. Physical on Shabbos is spiritual. Shabbos is, why do we say Shabbat Shalom? Peace on Shabbos. Because Shabbos is the time when the physical and the spiritual combine. We have a mitzvah to light candles, to drink wine, to have Shabbos meal, to get together with the family. Things that overtly, on the surface, they're physical. But they're not. You know there's a special mitzvah that a person and his wife are together Friday night? Special mitzvah. Friday night is the time a couple is supposed to have intimate time together. Special mitzvah. It's a mitzvah. Because it's not the physical of the Egyptians. It's not the physical that the woman walks away from and says, boy, was that empty. What am I? I'm just this vessel. No, it's a spiritual. So Shabbos is a time when we we can reconnect, we can abolish the darkness that's within, and therefore we can have the light that's without as well. Now, we just spoke in general terms. We began opening up the concept of Shabbos. We began. But it's that's why we sing, what do we sing on Shabbos? Me'in olam haba. This is an example of the world to come. Why is it an example of the world to come? Because I have gefilte fish, that's what's going to be in the world to come? Because I have chon? What's the me'in olam haba?
If they have chon in the olam haba, I
would be. Oh, that's not what we're singing about. We're singing about a totally different world. We're singing about a world of me, my soul, God, the Jewish people, different world. A world which when I can connect to, then I'm beginning to sense true happiness. But most people spend their lives without true happiness. We were given a secret. We were given a gift. It is the one mitzvah that God describes as a gift. Before God gave us Shabbos, God called Moshe in and said, go tell the Jewish people I have a special gift to give them. Why did God have to call it a gift? Usually when you give a gift, the guy says, oh, a Porsche, a brand new Porsche, wow. 0 to 150 in 3 seconds, turbo, wow. You don't have to tell him you're giving him a gift. Because Shabbos on the face of things is not a gift. When you look at Shabbos, you say, wait a second. My competitors are working. I'm not working on Shabbos. What kind of gift is this? I can't turn on a light. That's your gift, God? I can't shave. I can't answer my cell phone. That's a gift? Yeah, on the surface, it's not. You have to see beyond the surface. That's why it needs introduction. God calls Moshe in and says, go tell him I have a gift. It's a gift. And it is one of the only mitzvot that is a defining mitzvah. A person wants to be an Orthodox Jew, we call him, is he Shomer Shabbos? Does he keep Shabbos? So, a few thoughts. And if you think about the points we discussed today, what's deep down inside a person, the connection to a person's wife, the connection in a marriage, if you stop and think, you'll see that all the points are connected. But you have to think. They didn't make it easy for you. Figure if you guys came, you want to think. So think. And I think that we still have to discuss what is love, what is marriage, what makes a good marriage. But we've started, because we've started in understanding ourselves. So, I'm sorry I tricked you at the beginning of class, but I thought it was worthwhile.